I woke up one morning, I thought, I don't want to go to work today. And I just needed a change. So I went to the managing director who'd employed me and said, I'm not enjoying it anymore. And he said, well, you can't leave. And I was like, what do you mean I can't leave? We want you to stay. So have a think about what you want to do. And so a couple of weeks later, I went back and I said, well...
While working with Barry White, Gladys Knight, and David Bowie, artists all used to crowd commotion.
One of your roles was Vice President of International at EMI. Can you tell us some of the artists you worked with at that time?
Queen, Blur came on the scene.
Tell us when you first came across Amy Winehouse.
Just before.
You've built this from the picnic in Texas to what is now one of the big things at South by Southwest,
the British Music Embassy, and later UK House,
where UK creative organisations and musicians come out. Another artist you like, David Bowie, right? What's he like?
He treated you like you would want to be treated, with respect.
Greetings, I'm Ashley Samuels McKenzie.
And I'm Charles Parkinson.
And welcome to How I Became,
where we unveil the unscripted journeys of inspirational figures.
If you enjoy the show, could you do one thing? Subscribe. Wherever you are, just click the subscribe or follow button. That simple act can help us grow the podcast in a big way, and we need your support to do it. And if you really want to help play a part in our growth, rate us on Spotify or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean the world. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by Uber, shaping the future for consumers as they go anywhere and get anything. Advertising on Uber connects brands with hundreds of millions of people using Uber around the world in the moments that move them most. To learn more about what we can do for your brand, visit uber.com/advertising.
Hi, I'm Phil Patterson, and this is how I became the music specialist for UK Government Department for Business and Trade.
Starting life up in Newcastle, being a singer in the choir may have sparked his affiliation to music. He became part of a band and learning the ropes of organising a few gigs, to DJing and moving into regional radio for record labels and then TV promotion, while working with Barry White, Gladys Knight and David Bowie, artists all used to crowd commotion. He then built the bridge between the music industry and government to take the UK music out as a trade export across the globe, to facilitating trade missions for artists, putting them on the stage for their skills to be shown. So now if you're an artist or band ready for the international stage, I may have to introduce you to Phil Patterson, music specialist for the Department of Business and Trade.
Hi, Ash.
So, before we get into your story, we always give a bit of context for people listening, who the expertise they have in the room, we have in the room. You've got an incredible amount of knowledge about the music industry, hence why the government called you up and said, can you help us? And so you were, one of your roles was Vice President of International at EMI. Can you tell us some of the artists you worked with at that time?
At EMI, I came in via Chrysalis Records. Chrysalis Records was bought out by EMI, and I ran the international division there. So we continued to work with the Chrysalis artists as well as moving into the EMI. And so we had, on the Chrysalis roster, we had the likes of Sinead O'Connor, Huey Lewis in the News, Billy Idol, bands like that, artists like that. And then at EMI, we moved into working with the likes of Eternal, Blur, Robert Palmer.
Did you work with David
Queen.
Bowie at there? Or was that before?
No, that was at RCA.
I see.
Many years before.
And
Queen
work,
as well.
Queen, yes. So some incredible artists. And for anybody who doesn't know, EMI, the legendary UK record label, who currently have artists such as Justin Bieber, Katy Perry, Taylor Swift, to name a few notable artists. Any drum and bass heads in the room, Chase and Status are also on EMI. Lethal Bizzle is on EMI. Migos, 2 Chainz. So some really interesting artists. Big, huge organisation, which, as you said, you were Vice President of International there. And now on to what you're doing today, which is working with the Department of Business and Trade. What do you do? What's your role in
My role really is to try and find ways to work with the industry generally, find out what the industry are wanting to have to develop their artists and their businesses going forward. And so we work with the trade bodies likes of the BPI, which is the British Phonographic Industry, record labels, the AIM, who is the Association of Independent Music for Independent Labels, the MMF, Music Managers Forum, Music Publishers Association, etc. And what we do is we talk to them as well as the individual companies themselves as well, and try and form a blueprint of how we can assist the development of those businesses. And the businesses include, of course, the artists, because that's the product. Forgive me for calling music and an artist's product, but that's the product that's being sold via these businesses. And so there's an awful long tail as well that we can get involved with, from agents, management companies, publishers, as I said, merchandise companies, touring businesses, service industries. So there's lots and lots of different instrument manufacturers, lots of different areas in which we can try and support the industry generally.
And one of the interesting stories which we'll get to is your involvement with Amy Winehouse in the very early stages of her career. And something that we're going to talk about today and also involved in this is South by Southwest. So this is a two-parter, everybody. We're doing one part here, and the next time you'll see us will be in Austin, Texas, at South by Southwest, which is where you were. We won't tell this story yet, but Amy Winehouse went out there with you, along with many other artists, and have continued to do throughout the years you've been working with the government. So that's all to come. You'll see us in Austin, Texas at some point.
Certainly will.
So now that's this sort of, that's the context and precursor. Now let's get into your story. Mm-hmm. Tell us about where you grew up in the north of England. And you do go, on this show, we talk about people's personal stories. And you also do go through something as a young 13-year-old, which I think a lot of people can resonate with. So just set the scene first of your family life and then how things progressed.
Yeah, I was born in Newcastle upon Tyne, as you might tell by the accent. And
Slightly tell,
yeah. I suppose I've softened it over the years.
I can tell.
Because when you're travelling internationally, people can't really understand you unless you slow it down a little. But anyway, it's still there a touch, and it comes back an awful lot more when I go back up to the northeast or talking with a fellow Geordies. My mum was the daughter of a priest, and who, from a family of her father, was one of nine brothers, eight of which were priests.
Wow!
So it was it was High Church of England, I think, is what I remember. And so we were brought up in not a heavily religious family, but we were brought up in we'd go to church, every week. And as soon as I was old enough, I guess, I was introduced to the choir, which Ashley mentioned earlier about singing. And, I sort of probably did about 6 or 7 years at that. And my mum tried to get me to learn the piano, which, of course, these days I wish I'd taken up. Mm-hmm. But I was about 9 or 10 years old at the time when she was trying to get me to do that, and I was much more interested in football and everything else that was going on. But that was the sort of, my dad was in the army, and so it was a fairly stable and upbringing that we had. We weren't very well off. We lived in council house, and there was plenty of ups and downs with all of that, as I'm sure many people can relate to. You know, I remember hiding behind the settee when the rent man came one time, sort of whilst you sort of, you know, pretended you weren't in the house because you were, couldn't afford to pay the rent that week.
Oh, wow.
Stories like that. So, but we got by and, you know, we came through it. And as you mentioned, unfortunately, around the time, I think it was about 12, 13 years old, my mum and dad decided to split. And mum went off. I was one of four children, second oldest. And my mum left and went down, came down to London with my younger brother and sister, something which was a bit traumatic at the time, as you can imagine.
Mm.
And but we survived. And my eldest sister, Valerie, she was 5 years older than me, so she was sort of became mum of the house and all that sort of stuff.
Mm. What do you remember thinking about at that time about that whole scenario? What was it like?
It was pretty traumatic. It was, I thought that you know, that maybe I'd go with mum eventually as well. But we, you know, we were both teenagers at the time, and so it quickly became quite evident that dad wasn't around as much as he, you know, he'd be there through the week and then he'd go and stay with a friend weekends and stuff. So Valerie and I became sort of, we did our own thing mostly, you know, but she was old enough to manage it well and you know, helped bring me up, I guess. And I suppose it allowed me to have a bit more freedom to do what I wanted to do and things. And at school at that point, a good friend of mine, Bob, they'd started a band and, you know, I was sort of quite envious trying to see if I could get into this band and tried to learn to play bass guitar, tried a bit and didn't really work out very well because they were so far, you know, two or three years ahead of me, I think. Yeah. And so it was just a case of, okay, well, we still want you to be involved, you know. So when got to age about 15, I think, started to do the odd gig in church halls and that sort of stuff and school gigs and things. So that started to do the sound and took that road rather than actually playing in the band,
mm-hmm.
Which was still great fun and, you know, enjoyable. And Bob and I were both pretty decent at art at school. We did our A-level art and everything. And, you know, so it was like, we'll go to art school. We'll try and get into art school. So we got to the point, I think, about 16 and a half, 17, maybe 17. And the band was starting to get quite a few gigs in the Northeast. And I heard it a couple of days ago when I was walking past somewhere, the Foundations' "Build Me a Buttercup" song, which you probably both know.
Yeah.
I remember we got offered this chance to support the Foundations at, at a club in Sunderland.
How old were you at the time?
Say 16 and a half,
goodness
17.
Nice.
Still at school. And so this is a nightclub, Annabelle's in Sunderland, which I don't think is there these days. But anyway, we accepted the gig and went. But the deal was that it was being a nightclub, they were on quite late. And of course, you'd got your gear in and everything. And it was in a high-rise block, and you had to take your equipment up and down the stairs and all that sort of stuff.
Wow.
And but you couldn't get out until 2 o'clock in the morning when the club finished. So I remember we got home at about 4:30, 5 o'clock or something after unloading from the gig and getting home and supposed to be at school that following morning.
Yeah, that's past your bedtime.
Oh, well past your bedtime. Exactly, yeah. And, you know, so obviously slept in that morning and went in at lunchtime. But that sort of sticks in my mind. But it was a great gig and great memory to sort of take you on the road to what was going to happen going forward. And following on from that, you know, we did the band just got better and better, and we were doing various gigs, support acts, support gigs around. I remember we played at Durham University, Dunelm House, supporting Free were headlining, and I think it was Sutherland Brothers and Quiver were the next act on the bill, and then it was us. And it was the week that All Right Now went to number one, which again is a pretty famous song, and so everyone would know. So it was a great gig again, you know, and so it went on, and we started getting offered gigs in London, and so we came down a few times to do the odd gig here for like £15 at the Marquee supporting whoever was going
to
be.
Does that £15 have to go around everybody?
£15 was everything.
Wow,
Got you down here. That was
food, hotel,
everything.
Wow.
So your young music career is budding,
yeah.
But you're still at art school.
Yeah, well, by then I think we did 2 years at art school, and you did your foundation years, and I was doing fashion design.
Okay.
Surprisingly, Bob was doing graphics. And at the end of the second year, they said to us, "Look, you know, you've either got to, because we were missing a lot of college, and they were saying you've either got to quit the group or quit college." So we quit college.
There you go.
It was, that was what we were going to do. So we quit college, and then not long after that, the band. Was starting to, people were getting offers from other bands and stuff like this. So the band didn't split, but a couple of the guys left, and then we got a couple of other people in, and were called Yellow by then. And then after that became Blondie, which was...
You were Blondie before Blondie?
Well, I wasn't, but the band
they
was,
were.
Obviously. But yeah. This was like 1970.
Okay.
69, 70. And,
there wasn't a blonde female in the group that became Blondie.
No, definitely
no,
it's not,
a different
Blondie. That was the thing. Why are you called Blondie? Not if you're blonde. But so that was interesting. But then that sort of lineup sort of carried on for about a year or so. And then a couple of the guys got offered the chance to go and form a band with another local singer at the time, who was in a different band, and they formed a band called Geordie, and who, of course, had Brian Johnson as the lead singer.
Who is, for people who don't know?
AC/DC singer.
Ah, okay.
So they had a couple of hit records on EMI, actually, and this was now, I think it was about 72 or 73. And by then, I'd started DJing, and I was doing club circuit around the Northeast and DJing and everything else.
And tell us about, this is quite interesting for, you know, there'll be people who will remember this time and people who are younger who don't. Radio stations. You didn't always have loads of radio stations with ads and everything. What were radio stations like at this time?
It was BBC. Still BBC, but
that was the only station you could tune into.
Pretty much. I mean, Radio Luxembourg.
And what's the story there? Is it basically you could sort of tune in to Luxembourg.
Radio Luxembourg was sort of the only, after the pirate radio stations had been closed down.
Which is what? Just explain that again for maybe a young audience don't know how it all went down.
Pirate radio stations were often based on ships.
Literally in the sea. And why on earth would they be on a ship in the sea?
Because they didn't have a license to broadcast in the UK or in Europe and everything else. And they could broadcast from the sea. They could broadcast into the UK, into Europe, and around the world. And that was how the Radio 1 at BBC started, really, because there was such a demand for pirate radio stations in the 60s and the pop music that they were playing, the popular music, contemporary music that were being played at the time, that young people really wanted to do this. And Radio Luxembourg wasn't a pirate station because it was based, headquartered out of Luxembourg, but they had offices in London and everything as well. And so they could broadcast, but it was always a very crackly sort of AM signal.
You're literally tuning in from the signal coming from Luxembourg.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, at the time. And
this is because in the UK law at the time is that only the BBC can broadcast on radio. Is that how it was?
Pretty much, yeah. So, and then Radio 1 obviously started because of the demand. And then of course Radio 2, etc. followed. But they realized that popular music contemporary pop music was something that was going to drive an audience.
I see.
And therefore, they wanted to be part of it. And the government had to give in and say, yeah, okay, we'll do this, but we'll do it under our control. And right. So that was sort of how that all started. But Luxembourg continued for another 10, 15 years. I don't know the exact date that Radio Luxembourg sort of stopped broadcasting, but certainly later in my career, I would visit the offices in London and speak with Tony Prince and the guys there who ran Radio Luxembourg.
Right, so, nice.
But, yeah.
So talking about career, how did you enter the music industry?
A friend of mine who I started working with when I was DJing, Lawrence Laybourne, who's still around up in the Northeast, and him and his brother have got a string of restaurants and bars and stuff in the Northeast still these days. And he was a good friend of a guy that was working, who was actually in another band previously, and he'd left his band to go and join Island Records at the time as a promotions person. Mm-hmm. Promotions person was plugging radio and television with the records, trying to get them to persuade them to play the new releases and everything else. And so Arthur Cookson, who was this guy I was talking about, he was at Island Records, and then there was another friend who Phil Lowry, who also played in a band called the Georgia Quintet, I think. It was a local Northeast band as well, a bass player in there, so I knew him pretty well. And he left his band to go and work for Pi Records, doing the same sort of job that Arthur had got. So I was quite envious of this road into the record labels, you know. And I'd been started to go for sales jobs and things like that. And it was I wasn't really a salesperson, so it wasn't something that I was going to get into. So I went for a few interviews and failed miserably getting those jobs. And then Phil, this guy, had been in his job for, I think, about a year and a half. So this is about late 74. And he got offered a job at Sony Records, or CBS Records at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw me and he said, oh, I heard you're trying to get into the record business. You know, do you fancy going for an interview to see if you can get... So I got an interview and everything. I came down to London, had an interview with a guy called Izzy Price, who ran the promotions department just off Marble Arch, actually. And so went in there, thought I'd done pretty well. And about a week later, I got a call saying, sorry, Phil, you know, we've taken someone else on.
Yeah.
But you were certainly in the last two or three, and, you know, we'll keep you on file if anything changes, and we'll let you know if you're still interested.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, and great. Then on to the next one, I was thinking, you know. Then about 3 months later, I got a phone call from Izzy saying, you're still interested in the job? And I'm like, I thought you gave it to someone else.
He said, yeah.
Well, we did, but didn't work out, and we've got rid of him, and so we'd like to talk to you again. So that was so I went in, another interview, and I started, I think, 3 days later.
Okay.
You know, so it was, and I was covering the northeast of England, Scotland, so doing all radio, television, and all that sort of stuff. And coming back to your question before, Charles, about radio and where commercial radio, I suppose, started. It sort of in the early to mid 70s when Capital Radio started.
Right.
I think they were the first commercial station, I think.
And what does that mean for it to be a commercial station?
Well, it was you were playing adverts, you know, commercial television, same thing. So your programs were interrupted. It was paid for by the advertising revenue that came into the station.
As opposed to the taxpayer through license fee.
Exactly.
BBC.
The BBC, yeah. Exactly. So Capital Radio started, and then I think it was Piccadilly Radio in Manchester, Radio Clyde in Glasgow, Radio Forth in Edinburgh, Metro Radio in Newcastle. And there was BRMB, I think, in Birmingham. So there was about 8 or 10 stations sort of gradually opened up over a sort of year or two.
Yeah.
And that was hence the birth of commercial radio. And the record companies obviously recognized the opportunity to, we can promote our records regionally now, as well as just Radio 1 in London. Mm. So hence the regional radio promotions and television promotion people. And so when I got the job at Pi Records, the first thing I decided to do was look for other opportunities to try and promote the artists and the music that we were trying to do. So I'd start going to record stores, obviously television, newspapers, local newspapers. And so I sort of grew the job for myself, if you want, because initially my brief was radio and television if you could get it. Yeah. And that was it. But I thought, well, there's a lot more that you can do if you can get a local radio station to start playing your records, make sure the records are in the local stores, and if you can get a story in the local newspapers and build a picture.
Yeah.
It was the same, same thing that I would tell any artist now, that if you've got to build an audience for yourself locally to start with, and if you can get a demand for that, then you can grow it in other parts of the country. When we first started with bands, you would play your local town or your local village or whatever it was, and then you'd play the next village and then next town. And so, you know, I'm obviously exaggerating a little there, but you'd build an audience, and gradually, hopefully, you'd cover the whole country and find an audience for yourselves as well, you know? And it's much the same way to support that with promotion, sales, and everything else that I started to try and do in this job with Pi Records.
Fascinating. So you get this role and you sort of make your own job per se. One of the artists you're working with this time, Barry White.
Yeah, it was 20th Century Fox Records, the 20th Century label, and I was like, all of a sudden we had the new Barry White album coming out. It's like, ooh, you know, this was 1975 when I started my first year. It was the singles came out, and then we had the album, and he toured with the UK, and he did Manchester, the Bellevue Arena, which is where I went down there and helped them get some radio television sort of interviews and things like that, and see the show, and took some of the local people down from Newcastle radio station down to see him and do an interview and things, and just gradually, you know, build that sort of, help build this whole story around Barry White. But amazing, they had the Love Unlimited Orchestra, Love Unlimited, the singers as well, who had their own music coming out too. Mm. So a great time. And you know, you couldn't fail, to be totally honest, with music like that at the time. It was tremendous. Because it worked both on radio, in the clubs, at home and everything, you know, it just fitted the bill.
Nice. And another artist you like, David Bowie, right? Many people did at the time, but you're not surely thinking you're ever going to work with him.
Not at all. I was a huge fan of David Bowie's from the early 70s, so, you know, Ziggy Stardust and all of that. So, and Hunky Dory, the album before that too. At the end of 75, having done my first year as a radio promotions guy, RCA Records, who were David Bowie's label, the guy that was heading the regional team at the time, he called me up because I'd met him a couple of times. He called me up and said, "Oh, you know, we'd love to offer you a job for the Northeastern Scotland." And I was like, "Oh, really? You know, work with David Bowie, the chance to work with Bowie and similar sort of acts." So, again, I came down to London, had an interview with them in Curzon Street, a month later I was working for RCA Records, and I think we had, so this is now 76, and we had Low, the album which he did in Berlin, I think, and so that was the first album I worked with him on, and I met him. briefly that year a couple of times, doing interviews and things. But
what's he like?
A lovely fella, to be fair. I mean, just he treated you like, you know, you would want to be treated with respect, something which I'd always tried to do myself over the years, to treat everyone the same way that I wanted to be treated myself, you know. And whether it's the mail boy or the CEO, it's like, you know, we're all there doing the best we can. And so, you know, have a little respect and try and treat them with that respect and in the way that you'd want to be treated yourself. And David was that sort of person. He would always have time to talk to people, and you know, so it was great. He I didn't spend lots of time with him. I mean, you know, late in the second stint I had at RCA, I spent maybe a little more time. But in that first year and a half, it was just getting to know the different artists and stuff. But David was, yeah, a gentleman, I think, is probably the best way to describe him.
Certainly. And a couple of other artists people will know, Iggy Pop, Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
You're responsible for getting...
Well, I was obviously part of the team that were doing that, yeah. Iggy Pop, a great story on the Idiot album, which was 77. Going back to David Bowie, he actually played keyboards for Iggy on the tour.
Oh.
I think he produced the album as well, I'm pretty certain.
Wow.
So up in Newcastle, they played the City Hall, or Iggy played the City Hall, and I'd arranged to do a television interview on the local news programme, the 6 o'clock local news programme, you know, that still happen these days, actually. So I'd arranged it with the studios themselves, but the presenter that was going to do the interview was an old friend of mine from art school, and Lynn Spencer, that was her name. So I'd given her all of the information for the interview. Met Iggy. She came and met Iggy in the green room before the program started, and he was perfect gentleman, chatting away to her and everything. And so then it was a live interview, live television. So we came to the ad break or whatever, because it was on Tyne Tees television. Iggy, or time on this sofa, as it were. So I remember he went and sat down, and he had leather trousers on, black leather jacket on or whatever. So they opened the set with the next part of the program. And Lynn said, "Today we've got a special guest who's playing the City Hall tonight. And I believe it's the first time you've been in Newcastle at the City Hall, Iggy. Is that true?" And he just stared at her. Didn't say a word.
Oh, whoa.
And then stuck. Slid down a little bit like this. Stared at her. And she was looking across at me, at the corner of her eye, and at the producer, a director rather, and like, what do I do now? And silence. And to her credit, after about 30 seconds, she asked another question. And he started to slide down a bit more, silence, and started to undo the top of his trousers.
Oh, no.
And I could see her going... So guys, another question. So he asked another question, and he's gone, "Yeah, well, it is the first time I've been in Newcastle." And you can see she was staring at me and going, having known her, you know, a long time. And it was one of those moments that you sort of, the whole studio just went,
yeah.
Because this is like 6:15, 6:20 on, you know, local television,
yeah,
and family audiences and everything. But he didn't do anything wrong.
No.
Didn't say anything. But at the end of the interview, when they went off to do something else, and he went across to him and said, "Sorry about that. It just, you know, it's always nice to sort of make a mark. And, you know, I hope you didn't mind."
Certainly was like to make a mark.
Wow. And then, of course, we went off to the City Hall, and he played his show. And as I say, David Bowie was playing keyboards on the whole show. And I remember at the end of the night, Iggy and David ran off stage and into a waiting car and went off to the hotel. And the rest of us followed on the sort of tour bus back down to the hotel, and sitting in the bar, having a drink with the band and everything. And about an hour later, the elevator doors opened, and out came James Osterberg, who was Iggy Pop.
Right. So,
but the real James. And but Iggy was always known for his leather trousers and his, you know, his hair and his persona.
Yeah.
But he was, this time he was in his golf trousers and his polo shirt, hair slicked down, a pair of glasses. So no one would really recognize him at all. And everyone was like, whoa. Well, I was, at least, because it was the first time I'd seen him do that sort of thing. He probably did it every night. But So interesting story.
I should great say, music. Just because some people listen on Apple Podcasts where you can't see the video. So when the moments of silence, Phil is sliding down his chair, which is what Iggy Pop was doing.
Very slowly as well.
Just so you know what's going on.
Yes.
And you talked about something in terms of, you know, for 18 months, I think, you tried to get into the music industry and you couldn't get in there. And then you did. But you talked about, you know, if you want to do something, you've got to put your heart and soul into it and be the best version of yourself. Is that what you did? And for anyone who's listening to this, who's got a goal, they might be a CEO, they might be an executive, or they might be starting off in their career. What advice do you have for sort of going out there and getting what you want?
Yeah, I think everything that you just said is what I believe, and I probably still try to do. It depends on what sort of life that you want, really, I think, yourself. And you know, if you just want to start a 9-to-5 job and it's a job which pays the bills and that's it, and then that's fair enough. And as lots of people are very happy with that. Myself, I was wanting more, certainly wanting more from the career I chose.
Mm.
To enjoy it, as well as obviously be rewarded and, you know, have nice things and all the rest of it that comes with it. But also the opportunity to meet people, travel the world and everything along those. But the thing that I've always tried to do is, as I said earlier, is to treat people with respect and everything else. And if you do that and you're putting everything into the work that you're doing, that, you know, you're not leaving a stone unturned to resolve an issue or a problem. By doing all of those things, I think itself, it just takes you to the place that you want to be, and therefore, hopefully, you're doing a good job.
Mm.
You know, I've always tried to just do the best I can, and at the end of the day, if it's not good enough, a bit like when I tried to play the bass guitar. Maybe I didn't at that point in life, probably didn't realize if I'd put a lot more effort in, I probably could have achieved it. Mm. But in the end, it worked out okay.
Mm.
Because it introduced me to the industry and, you know, and I DJed and all of that sort of stuff. So by doing all of that, that taught me that, yeah, if you want something, you can go and get it. And if you work hard at it, you're going to get better and you achieve your goals.
Mm.
And that's what I would say to anybody that's trying to come into any industry, you know.
Someone senior who wants to make a change of industries, maybe they're tired and fed up of doing the same thing for 20 years, you still hope to change if you focus.
Yes, certainly I think that's true. You can look to, you hear lots of people these days, you know, doing mentoring schemes and everything else to support people coming into the industry generally, or any industry that you've done. But from that, I think a lot of people who, you know, have been in a career for a period of time, they've got to a certain level and then thought, is there much more I can really do in this? So what are the path? Can I use the skills I've learned to go and benefit someone else and other people? I mean, you were talking before we started about pennies,
you know, charity. Yeah. Yes, another episode.
And, you know, and you know, that was a great story in my mind. The short piece that I heard from you guys, and I'll certainly go and listen to the podcast when it comes on.
Yeah.
So it's,
and just for people who don't know, it's the story of going from finance, the world of finance, CEO in a FTSE 250 company, to starting up a charity. She'd never done it before. Alison Hutchinson, if you want to watch that episode, who's now CEO of Penneys.
But I think that's a great story, because it's giving back, but also changing your career to a degree, a big degree actually, and one assumes hopefully enjoying our life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Possibly even more now.
I think so. Absolutely, you can see the passion and hunger.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the next stage.
So then, from RCA, you then move on into Polydor Records.
Yeah.
And your position was to run the whole of Polydor Records outside of London.
The regional promotion team.
The regional promotion
team. That's what it was. It was
outside of London.
It wasn't quite as grand as running the whole of Polydor Records. But
That's in our notes. It says running the whole country outside of London. It's an abbreviation for promotions.
Yeah, yeah.
Whole country outside of London.
But, it sounds good there.
But so I'll take it. It does.
But set the scene. So this is around the time a very famous movie, Grease, had been released to the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And so much more.
Yeah, Polydor Records, RSO Records, Robert Stigwood organization, was one of the labels that within Polydor. And Saturday Night Fever had already been out, I think, the year before. And I was invited to go and run, as you say, the regional promotion team at Polydor Records, so everything outside of London, in the UK. And I had a team, I think, of about 8 or 10 people working with me at the time. We'd plot strategies for different artists and things like that. So with something like Grease, to be honest, it wasn't that much hard work, because the movie was doing the promotion for you.
Yeah.
And but it was still great, because everyone, welcomed you with open arms, because you had the new track from Grease and everything else, So it was a great time to be working at Polydor from that commercial perspective as well. Mm. But at the same time, we also had the punk era had sort of really kicked in, and we had Susie and the Banshees, The Jam, Sham 69, The Cure formed off the back, and Chris Parry, who was the founder of Fiction Records, he was in the Polydor family, and I'm certain exactly how he started the label. I think he probably got financed through Polydor. I could be wrong there, but Fiction Records became part of the Polydor family, along with Chris and The Cure were signed, and we had some great records out then. So there was good stories, I think, around both the RSO stuff with the Bee Gees, and because obviously all the Grease and Saturday Night Fever stuff was involved in all of that. And so that was a great time. Eric Clapton was signed to RSO Records as well at the time. So some great artists, and Roxy Music were on Polydor at the time. Great time. But the some of the stories from the sort of punk era. Susie and the Banshees, I remember being in Belfast with them, which was in, it was 1979 by now. And Susie and the Banshees were touring, and The Cure were the support act. And I think it was probably only the second or third gig on the tour. And I was with the band doing promotion in Belfast and everything else. And we'd done a couple of interviews sort of around lunchtime, left them to sound check in the afternoon at the venue, gone back to the hotel. A couple of hours later, come back to find out there'd been a bust up in Susie and the Banshees.
Oh no.
Two of them had walked out, leaving Steve and Susie, I think. And so Susie had persuaded Robert Smith to play guitar for her that night, and the drummer as well, I think. And Robert then, he played the rest of the tour He did all the Susie and the Banshees set as well as his own Cure set as well.
Wow.
And I think Budgie joined Susie and the Banshees not long after to do the rest of the tour. And it subsequently, you know, became an item, I think, as a couple. But it was just like a fascinating time within Polydor Records generally to work there, you know. And I say Susie and that was one story. The Cure as well, I remember probably the same year being at Reading Festival, and the Cure were doing, it was their first festival, but it was a horrible sort of afternoon, cold, wet, and the Police were headlining, and Sting had not long before done the Quadrophenia movie, where he was starring in that.
Yeah.
So he had the old blonde, bleached blonde hair with the Parker image and all of that. And so he was that was his headline set on that, or their headline set that night was. But I remember the Cure had gone on earlier in the afternoon, done their set, and backstage then it was Caravans, Little Caravans, and depending on how big the band were, was how big the caravan was. And I remember the Cure were in their caravan, and just chat. It was probably around 5-6 o'clock in the evening, starting to get dark because it was just a horrible night and everything. And in the next caravan along were Motorhead, and you know, and of course, you know, with Lemmy and Motorhead and all that. And I remember the Cure sort of looking out the window, like into Motorhead's caravan, go, "What the hell's going on in there?" You know, and there was sort of drinking, and there was girls in there, and I mean, just fun, having a lot of fun. But like, whoa, wow! And they were, the Cure were sort of quite new to all of this, and it was quite. Sort of an image which stuck in my mind for many years.
Yeah,
as well,
sweet know, so. Moment. So it's around this time that you start a family.
Yeah, I mean, we got married, Catherine and I got married April 77. We moved to London toward the end of that year when I joined RCA. I'd worked with RCA up in the north for about 6-8 months, I think, and then they invited me to come down to London. And so we came down to London, lived out in Purley in Surrey, and had some friends who lived out that way, so it was good. Our first son was born a year and a half, December 78.
Okay, what's his name?
Lewis.
Lewis, yeah. Okay.
We lived in the south for 4 years and then moved back to the northeast because Catherine was having, I was out working a lot and she was pretty homesick, no family around her and everything. So we decided we'd move back to the northeast and I would commute at weekends to see how things would go. So that was what we did. And then our second son, Elliot, was born in Newcastle in 83. And not long after that, we moved back down to live out in Berkshire, and then our third son was born in 86.
Mm-hmm.
So Elliot was 83 and Jamie was 86.
Okay.
So the three of them have loved music, of course, and
you had three boys. They must have had a great time coming with Dad to different gigs and seeing loads of cool things. And you eventually, you take a few more roles, but you eventually go independent.
Yeah, and it was at this point where you get a call from someone at EMI that shows you a future hit record.
I got a phone call from the guy who's head of promotion at EMI Records, Malcolm Hill, and he said, "Oh, want to play you something? You want to pop in the office?" So I went in, and he played me this acetate, which is an acetate, for those of you who wouldn't know, is a white label of a record. But you can only play it about half a dozen times before it starts to wear out and stuff. It's the one before the comes off directly off the stamper and you know, so anyway, he played me this acetate, this record, and I said, "Who is it?" And he went, "Oh no, have a listen first. Have a listen." So I listened. I was like, "Wow, that's amazing." I said exactly what I said at the time because, I said, "It's a number one record. What do you want independent promotion for on this?" And he's going, and I said, "Who is it anyway?" And he went, "Well, who do you think it is?" I said, "I've got no idea. That's why I'm asking." Hmm. And And he's like, it's Queen. I was like, Queen? You got to be kidding. And it was Radio Gaga.
Ah.
And I said, why do you want independent promotion? And he said, I don't want independent promotion. He said, but Jim Beach, the manager, does. And he said, you know, I think you'd do a good job on it. And he said, they haven't had a hit for 2 years at this point. He said, so that's why Jim wants to get independent promotion in. So I was like, okay. And I was, yeah, I'd love to work on it. You know? Wow. So I remember taking the acetate back to my office, which was still in the old Charisma offices above the marquee. Mm-hmm. And I took it in and played it to a friend of mine who was running the publishing company at the time. And I said, have a listen to this. Listening, wow, who's that? I said, you're never going to guess. And he's like, well, tell me. I was, Queen, get out of here. And that was it. And then I remember taking it to Radio 1.
Mm.
And, of course, everybody, all the producers were like, wow, this is great. You know, everybody wanted to play it. And in the first week of release, first week that we had at Radio, we had 36 players at Radio 1, which... You know, just split it out in the day. It's, you know, because obviously everybody wanted the breakfast show were playing it. John Peel was playing it. And people, you know, you couldn't play it on every single show, but it was pretty much.
And what would normally be a great day for a good record?
A good record. If you got 15 to 20 players in a week, certainly in the first week, you'd be doing, people would be like, wow, you got a hit record here, you know? Became a huge hit, and then, you know, Live Aid and everything else. It was a memorable performance at Live Aid, I think. You know, off the back of that, you know, I got lots more work coming in as well and lots of offers. And so I worked, you know...
Did you meet Freddie Mercury?
I never met Freddie, actually. Okay. I met Brian May.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Beach I knew pretty well, manager, and all of his office. But no, Freddie was pretty reclusive, I think, at the time. And you know, so. But it was just an amazing record and a great album to work on. Of course, I worked on the album as well afterwards. Mm-hmm.
You go through a great period in your career. As you said, you're working on some fantastic records, huge artists. You're known for being someone who can get great promotion for these amazing records in history. And then fasting forward a little bit, everything changes. Yes.
You wake up one day and you just don't want to do it anymore. Tell us what's going through your head at that point.
I think a lot of people also will be able to resonate with this as they get to a stage in their career and they maybe they've been doing the same things for a lot of time and want something different.
Maybe people are probably looking at you like you're crazy, saying, what, you've had all this success, you know, like flying, but inside you're just like, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm.
Yeah, I was at Chrysalis Records by this time.
Mm.
As I said, when I was working independently, I did quite a few records for Chrysalis and they kept asking me to go work for them and run their promotion department, director of promotions at Chrysalis. And I refused it. And I think it was the third time that the managing director came to me and was like, what have I got to offer you to come in? So, you know, so we did a deal in the end and it was about, I'd been there, it was great company, Chrysalis Records. And I really enjoyed my stint there as well. And it was, I think, right about it, summer of sort of 86, I think, 86, 87, 86, I'm pretty certain. And I woke up one morning, went out summer's morning, about 6:30 in the morning, had a coffee, went and sat in the garden. I thought, I don't want to go to work today.
Mm.
And I'd never, you know, as you said, Charles, I'd never experienced that in all, I rarely took a day sick. You know, never mind not wanting to go to work. And so it was like, wow, this is something wrong here, you know. So I thought about it for a while. And obviously I went off came into London and went into the office and thought about it and pondered over it for a day or two. And then eventually thought, it was just becoming a little boring and the same. And you know, and I just needed a change of some sort. So I went to the managing director who had employed me in the first place and said, I think I've had enough, Doug, you know. And he said, what do you mean you've had enough?
Mm. How old are you at this point?
36. Oh, wow. 35.
Right.
35, 36. So he and he's like, what do you mean you've had enough? And I just said, well, I'm not enjoying it anymore, which is, you know, I couldn't have ever thought, envisaged that I would have got to that point. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, honestly, I don't know at this point, so I'll have a think about it. And he said, well, you can't leave. And I was like, what do you mean I can't leave? I said, he said, well, you can't leave. We want you to stay, you know. So have a think about what you want to do. And so a couple of weeks later, I went back and I said, well, maybe publishing or maybe international would be good if I'm going to stay in the business. And like, okay. Well, you know, try and decide which one. So a couple of more weeks went by and I thought international, I could probably do that, you know.
What does that mean?
What international means is basically you've got to try and plan a strategy for an artist. Obviously, it's easier if you've got a successful artist that's had, you know, hit albums and hit singles and things and hit tours, because people, you've built an audience and you just want to keep maintaining that or growing it, at least maintaining it, but hopefully growing it. And so you look to try and find different ways in which you can try and do that. So you'd, you know, television shows, you know, everything else, work with local promoters to try and, you know, with the management company and the agent to try and make sure that you want to do something in Japan and Australia. So let's try and work out the strategy to do all of that. So that was more or less what you were doing, you know. So I said international was the thing I'd like to do. And Doug eventually said, right, we found a spot, you know. And I said, by the way, I don't want to, if you're going to keep me here, I can't afford to be taking a salary cut and everything. He said, no, don't worry about that. It's fine, it's fine. So I went in as international marketing manager initially. And within 6 months, because the international director left and went off to Polygram at the time, they offered me the head of the department, director of international role. So I took that on then.
Any advice for someone who's, maybe at that stage in their career where they're a bit bored of doing the same thing, they've been very successful, but what would you say?
I think try and, you know, don't act too hastily. Make sure that, you know, it depends on where you're at in your career and where you are financially, your family life, your personal life generally, what your needs and wants are. But, you know, do something, do it for yourself and your family first and foremost, I think is the important thing. Enjoy what you're doing. I mean, people still say to me now, you're not going to retire, are you? And I'm like, well, I don't know. But it's, you know, why would you? You enjoy what you do. You know, and in fact, when I first met my current partner, Leslie, you know, she said, you're the only person that I know that loves going to work and loves their work and everything else that they do with it. And many, many people have said that to me over the years. And I think that if you're lucky enough to do that, you know, I mean, sports people, obviously, you know, musicians and you know, it's if you're lucky enough to do what you really want to do, you know, and you enjoy it, then it's not work. I heard somebody on an interview the other day say, you know, an actor was said, being interviewed on something and they were going and they said, well, you're working here. He said, hang on, let me just stop you there. It's not really work, is it? It's like, I'm an actor, you know, I play parts and, you know, yes, of course you put effort into it and everything else. And I think that's what I would say to people is depending on where they're at. Obviously, if they really need the job and to survive and everything, that's a different story. But most people that come to this sort of point in their life, I think, are probably quite comfortable in where they're at, and so they can make that change or they can afford to make that change. Otherwise, they've got to stay doing what they're doing. So I think it's that would be my advice is to do what you you know, you really want to do if you can afford to do that.
And it works out for you. Yeah, as you said, you take on this new role, and this does lead you to this role at EMI. But how does it come about?
Yeah, the EMI, what happened was not long after I think around about the same time as I took the job, just before I took the job on, EMI bought 50% of Chrysalis Records with the option to buy the other 50% within 3 years, I think it was. Yeah, because that came about. I'd gone away on a holiday, family holiday, a 2 week holiday. Came back, and I remember Mike Allen, who was the director of International at the time, and he said, "Oh, a good holiday." And I was like, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "Well, grab a coffee. I've got a few things to tell you about." And I was like, "Yeah." So I went back into his office, and he said, "A couple of things have been happening whilst you've been away." And I was like, "Okay, what's that?" He said, EMI have bought 50% of the company. All right, okay. He said, well, that was on the cards before you went, but it's happened. And I was like, okay. Doug Darcy, who was the MD who'd employed me in the first place, Doug's left. He's cashed his chips in, his shares, and he's left. We've got a new MD, Paul Conroy. Like, this is all happening in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, so we obviously talked about that. And then, and I said, okay, and anything else? He went, oh, yes, this is Monday morning. I said, you're going to Chile next Sunday. I'm going to Chile next Sunday?
America, right?
Yeah, exactly. So then, Mike Allen left not long after that, about 4 months after that, and I took over as director of International. And then they left us alone for a couple of years. And then I think around 91, and yeah, it was about 91, I think, 91 or 92. Rupert Perry, who was chairman of EMI in the UK, called me up and said he wanted to have a chat and asked me to go and be director of EMI International at the time. So, and it was the flattering thing to me was that there'd been lots of people coming from EMI into Chrysalis Records because by then they'd taken it over in totality. And so there was lots of people coming over to Chrysalis from EMI to take different positions in there. But I was the only person that was invited to go the other way, so, which was quite flattering.
Nice touch.
What did your remit change to?
A team of about 8 people working for me. We had to deliver, I think it was like 12.5 million net profit. And we did very well and delivered something like 14.5 million.
Nice.
And
this is your first year?
Yeah, first year in there. Yeah,
excellent.
Yeah. And they immediately thought, right, we can up these figures. And so the following year it went up to 18.5 million. I'm like,
lovely.
It's not like a manufacturing business, or you can't say, right, we sold 10,000 cars this year and we made this much profit. So if we sell 12,000 cars next year, we'll make this profit. You know, it's not quite as easy, and as because obviously it's music.
Yeah.
And the artists that you had in year one probably won't release an album in year two. So it's a different, so the cycle is not quite as easy. So you've got to look at every album that's forecast to be released within that financial year and try and forecast numbers of what you think they're going to do around the world. And your strategy as to how you're going to help them support them doing that with marketing spend and, tour support and everything else that comes with it. And that's how you sort of did your forecasts.
And tell us some of the artists you were promoting at this time.
Back to Queen, actually.
All right.
Was one of them. Queen, Blur came on the scene long after then. Eternal, I mentioned earlier, who did very well. Cliff Richard was still around.
Cliff Richard, nice.
Still around now.
Still around now, yeah, he hasn't stopped.
See me off, yeah. obviously all of the Chrysalis record artists we were still working with as well.
Yeah, you do. I mean, it goes very, very well. Again, you have a very successful time there. And then things change.
Things do change.
He is the doom and gloom man, isn't he?
Yeah, I bring in the heavy moments.
That's funny.
Things were going great. And then someone asks you if you would like to change your role and move to a new region, that region being of South Africa. Mm. What happens after this?
Yeah, I was asked if I'd be interested in moving down there. And at the time, my sons, I'd split from Catherine two years before, I think, around 93. But my sons were all at fairly critical ages in their lives and stuff, and I wanted to make sure I was around them and everything. So I probably dismissed the opportunity too quickly, if I'm with hindsight.
But give a bit of context, because what happened sort of from a management perspective at that time?
EMI had brought in various people from the outside with the new management structure, international from the States. They'd brought in various people in different roles. So there was a new person who'd been brought in as senior VP of international.
And you were currently VP of International,
yeah.
So he was above you.
Yeah.
He got brought in above
and,
you.
But he'd come in from the video world. And so, you know, I worked with him, real nice guy, and worked with him for a couple of years. Got on very well. At least we thought, we did actually. But helped him learn a lot more, I think, about what we were doing. And it just got to the point, I guess, that he decided that he wanted to change, not for any reason other than he just wanted to change the team, because it was still mostly my team on the EMI UK side of things and Parlophone. So he wanted to change things around a bit. So he just said, you know, out of the blue, you know, would you be interested? Because he'd moved one person, had gone, not from our team, but from a different area, had gone down to work in Australia. And so he said, would you be interested in, you know, being MD in South Africa? And I was like, as I said, rather hastily dismissed it. And for the reasons I thought were the correct reasons at the time, you know, mostly family. And I was still enjoying what I was doing anyway. So, you know, I wasn't really looking to move. But maybe I should have realized that there was something more afoot. And I don't know, 3 or 4 months later, he asked me to take on someone who I knew. I was more than happy to take them into the marketing team. And, you know, and so we brought this person into my team, who worked with me for a few months as well. And then eventually I was told that my services were no longer required.
Wow.
And it was a bit of a, it was a real shock, because it was the first time in my life that anyone had ever actually said, you know, so time's up.
You spent your whole career with people calling you saying, please go and work for me.
Yeah, please stay. You know, so it was a total shock. And I rang the chairman at the time, who was Rupert, who'd put me in the position in the first place. And I remember he said to me, sometimes when your face doesn't fit, it's probably time to move on.
You know?
And then, to be fair, they made me a good offer, which of course I refused, and managed to change that a little. But, you know, at the end of the day, I got a decent deal out of it and, you know, left and sort of sat and thought about what I wanted to do again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of people rang me and, you know, said, you fancy coming in for a chat? And I did with a couple of them, didn't fancy what they were offering. Then Miles Copeland, who managed the Police and had his own record label, IRS, which he'd recently sold to EMI, actually. He'd started a new label, Arc 21, and him and his UK team you know, I went in to see them, and he offered me a job working with them. So I went to run international for them. Yeah. Small label again, but which was quite nice and quite refreshing to go back to that in a way. But
and we got a question on that, actually.
What would you say to someone who's faced with the scenario you were faced with? So they've been invited to a role or asked to do something at an organization, they've turned it down, they're then faced with having to leave the company. What would you say that would help someone in that position?
This is something a lot of people going through right now, is being laid off. There's a lot of layoffs going in a lot of industries.
Yeah.
Any advice? Yeah. On
Well, I think that goes back to, hopefully you haven't burned too many people on the way up. So when you're on your way down, you can go back to those people and they're going to have some time for you and still be wanting to work with you. And so it goes back to treating people how you want to be treated. And so if you are made redundant in the first place, then, you know, who are you going to call, as it were? It's like, right, I need to continue to work, or I want to continue to work. Depends, again, what position you're in. And if you want to continue to work or need, then, you know, speak to the people that you've, you know, what do you want to continue to do? Do you want to continue doing what you're doing? Do you want to look into other areas, as we talked about earlier? And, you know, try and, I think we sort of covered it a little bit earlier, where go with your, you know, try and continue to do something that you love. And that's what I found at the time, was I got off a couple of offers of different things, but it's like, do I really want to do that? No. And so coming into a new company, getting an offer to go into a new company to try and help develop that company, was something quite nice in a way. I was comfortable. The salary and package offer was reasonable. It wasn't what I was on, obviously, but it was reasonable, and you could do it. So I think the advice would be, if you can find a suitable option that you're gonna be able to enjoy and try and help develop, then, you know, they are out there if you can, you know, but take a deep breath and you know, speak to the people that you have worked with over the years and in different areas and see what can come up. You know, don't give up hope, basically. It's, you know, when one door closes, you know, another one opens and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you don't know what one thing leads to the next, which is what happened in your case. So we get forward to today, really, or the current role you've been in.
And it's 2001 now, September the 11th.
Yeah.
And you're invited to a meeting that sets you on the path to where you are now. What happened in this meeting and what was proposed to you?
Yeah, of course, the September 11th date, which we all remember. I was at on the AIM International Committee, which was, you know, a voluntary role, in inverted commas.
And you said at the start, but just to remind people, AIM is...
AIM, the Association of Independent Music.
Yeah.
So it was I'd been working independently myself, working for lots of different labels, and obviously with my experience from the majors and independent sector.
Death Row Records being one of them.
Death Row Records, yeah. Well, that was the licensed deals that I did during my independent time toward the end of the 90s.
Did you ever meet the boss of...
No, he was in prison, I think, at that point, yes. No.
Okay.
The guy that I was doing the deals for, or working, doing the licensed deals for, he allegedly went out and met him two or three times.
Okay.
We did good deals in Australia, Japan, and...
What kind of artists?
Well, it was the Death Row catalog. It was basically finding a license deal for the Death Row catalog, which was, I think my memory serves me correctly, 22 or 23 albums. So, you know, the whole catalog, Dre, Snoop Dogg, etc. And so it was trying to find a license partner at the time that were willing to offer a decent advance and decent royalty to take on the catalogue. And so I did it, one deal for Europe, one deal for Japan, and one deal for Australia and New Zealand. And nice. So it was, we covered the world outside of North America.
What kind of money are we talking for someone to license that?
Honestly, can't remember. The royalty rates that I got were, I think, about 18 to 20%, which okay. Was okay, with decent advances up front, so mm-hmm. six-figure advances up front. Mm-hmm. But it was a catalogue which at that point was already, what, 9 years, 10 years old, I think, in some cases. And wow. And of course, there was always a little bit of nervousness from people when you start to talk about the Death Row catalogue anyway, as to, you know, what would come with it, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, everyone was happy with the deals that I did and did very well with that. And it was, you know, Japan was an interesting one. I mean, I did good deals there because I had some good friends there. And just going back to one of the things that Ash said earlier about dealing with people around the world and you know, the language barriers and all that sort of stuff. I think it's because I became friends with people, you know, and that was the thing I learned from early days doing promotion. If you could get in to see the people in the first place, the radio producers and television producers, because they liked you as a person, then they were going to listen to you and give you some time to present what you were going to be presenting, you know. So it was important to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now we reach a period where a lot of things change for you. In 2000, you meet Leslie, who you've been with for 24 years. And then in 2001, everything changed career-wise. Tell us what happened.
So the AIM International Committee was just a board to try and work on ideas that could help their members when looking to do things around the world. And I remember obviously we'd all sat through the carnage from New York around lunchtime, and then arrived at this meeting, which was at the Cook and Vinyl Records offices in Acton. And after we'd all got over the initial conversation about that, we had our meeting, and then I stayed behind with Alison, and who was the chair of AIM at the time, and Martin Goldsmith, who owns and runs Cook and Vinyl. And they said, we found it that we can get someone into a government department to support the music industry, or record labels primarily. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I said, well, the government don't really support the industry that much at the time, except maybe on lobbying issues and VAT and policy issues more so. And I said, so, you know, what is it? And they're like, well, it's a department called UK Trade and Investment, I think they were called then. And it was like, we can get someone in there that can help push things around the world, to, you know, do different, bring some money to the industry, to support the industry generally. And I was like, okay, well, I'll have a think about it. And if I think of anyone, I'll let you know. And they went, no, we mean you. And I was like, why would I want to do that? You know, as I said, the government don't really support anything. And they said, well, you know, we think we can try and help change things. So anyway, cut long story short, probably took about 15, 18 months before I actually got to the point where there was a deal on the table that I was happy enough to say, yeah, okay, let's do it. And the government department were happy to do this. So basically AIM and the BPI, who are the record label main record label trade body, they employed me and then seconded me to UK Trade and Investment, because that was the only way they could do it. And that was how it started. And so I went in there into this role, and the idea, they said to me, want to do trade missions and all of these sort of things. And of course, I was like, trade missions? What's a trade mission? You know, not something that you would think about within the music industry. So they decided to invite me on one of these trade missions, a general trade mission, to India. And so I spoke to various people, and I thought, well, I want to put a program together for myself. And so with the help of a very good guy in Mumbai, who was in post in Mumbai, we put together a week-long program for me. So I had 2 days in Mumbai, a day in Bangalore, a day in Chennai, and then back to Mumbai. And it was like full-on meetings, sort of just the way I'd always worked and, you know, right through my career, basically. And it was quite interesting when I went on this mission on the first, we arrived on the Sunday, and it turned out that most of the people who were there were on grants and everything, and they were, they had some business meetings and stuff, but they had friends and family maybe they were visiting as well. And so it wasn't quite what I expected, if you want, from their perspective. But that was seemed as though that was how a lot of things were happening at the time. There's a lot of good stuff came out of them, I think, of trade missions generally. And maybe this was just one that I'd gone on, and it because it wasn't specific to our industry, didn't really illustrate what was, you know, what their needs were. So anyway, I did my full week, and I got back afterwards and said to them, I'm not certain this is really, you know, what I want to do. And they're like, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, if that's what a trade mission's about, it's just because it seemed as though all you're doing is, you know, you've got a reception and then you connect people and then you let them get on with it, which of course there's nothing wrong in that. But I think we can do so much more. And they were like, what do you mean? I said, well, we could do a program ourselves. We could put education into the mix so that people are learning about the market up front and when we're in market as well. We can, and then have networking B2B sessions where people can really, you know, spend 20 minutes, half an hour with potential buyers and or business contacts and see if there's really interest in developing the businesses in the market. And then ultimately, hopefully, we'll be doing business. And they're like, oh, wow, that's sort of... So that's sort of... I said, well, if we can do that, then I'll happily stay and try and develop things. And that was sort of how it started. And I remember saying, can we do showcases? And they said, yeah, you can do showcases. And I said, do you know what I mean by a showcase? They said, well, yeah, of course. You bring the company and they present their product on the stage. And I said, well, yeah, sort of. I said, but I'm talking about showcases with the artists and musicians performing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the people who were there at the time were like, oh, that's something quite new. They can't really stay on a stage, can they, and present for hours on end. And I said, well, obviously not. I said, it's, you know, but they'll do a half hour performance or whatever to invited audience and all of that. And I said, it's, you know, this is not a car that we're talking about. This is music. And anyway, so gradually I managed to persuade them that we should look into the areas of showcasing and all of that sort of stuff as well. And you know, we've showcasing in various parts of the world, and South by Southwest being the biggest of those. But we didn't. Reeper Barn in Germany. Meadem was an event that used to happen in Cannes in the south of France. So we used to do that, which is where you mentioned Amy Winehouse
earlier. Well, yeah. Tell us when you first came across Amy Winehouse.
A friend of ours at the time, who worked at one of the agencies, and she was representing Amy Winehouse. We were talking about putting artists on at Meadem, which was the event I just mentioned in Cannes in the south of France, which at that point in time used to take place in January, at the end of January. And then, we'd done something the previous year at Meadem, and I suggested that maybe what we try to do is find an artist that we could, as part of a marketing campaign around an album, put them on it, showcase them at Meadem, and then showcase them at the Canadian Music Week, which used to happen at the beginning of March. And then a week later, they would do South by Southwest as well. So, you know, we worked out with the BPI and a couple of other people, we'd put a little bit of money in to support this, and we'd do this, and it would be an international showcase in three different sort of parts of the world. Unfortunately, Canadian Music Week, about just before Christmas, decided to move their dates, I think, to the end of April or something. So that fell out. But what we decided to do instead was put something in New York instead. And Amy Winehouse was one of the artists that was put forward as a potential, you know, by Caroline Reason. So it was a lady involved.
And had she, where was she at in her career?
It was just before Back to Black album was just about to be released.
Oh, wow.
And so I'd heard a couple of songs, I think, through Caroline from it. And we were like, wow, yeah, this is great, you know. It'd be great if they would do it. And so her management company and the agents were up to support it. Obviously, the record label were. And so, like we said, okay, let's lock these in. So we didn't put Meet'em in New York and South by Southwest. And we, you know, we were part of the jigsaw puzzle to make it happen. Obviously, the key elements were Amy herself, the record label and management company making, wanting it to happen and supporting us in a way that we were supporting them as well. And of course, just before Christmas, the first single came out and exploded. So by the time we got to Cannes at the end of January, you know, there was queues around the block. I think she came on at 8 or 9 o'clock, and we had a support act on it at 7:30 or something. And at 6:30, there was lines of people who were obviously all attending Meet'em, wanting to get in because they'd all heard about this amazing act. And then we did, obviously, the New York show at the Barry Ballroom en route to South by Southwest. That was the beginning of March. And then South by, she did two or three shows. By then, the album had exploded and, you know, everybody wanted a piece. And we did a barbecue thing at South by Southwest in the afternoon, and she was obviously the headline act for that. And it was at that point, I think after that week, we decided that, you know, we found out that Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland were all doing their own showcase events in Austin. And some of them were actually crossing over with the time-wise with what we were doing in the afternoon with Amy. And so it was like, this is crazy, guys, you know, we're competing against ourselves, never mind the rest of the world. So why don't we try and work together? And that was how the British Music Embassy was born from that. So.
Which is where we're going to see you next and do the final part of this episode, which is which is rather exciting. You've built this from, as you said, a picnic in Texas to what is now, you know, one of the big things at South by Southwest, UK House, where UK creative organisations and musicians come out and...
British Music Embassy was the first element.
Yeah.
And because obviously back then there wasn't a tech part of South by. And gradually, you know, when tech came into it, you know, we from a UK perspective, we started to look at what we could do. And I said, well, let's try and do, you know, do things within the British Music Embassy under that banner. And the British Music Embassy brand has become pretty well known around the world within the music industry. And people tell me, in fact, one of the directors at South By said to me a few years back, he said, that's the gold standard of what people should look at if they're going to, which was again quite a compliment to what we were doing. You know,
considering the hundreds, if not thousands, of events and things that are going on at South By, it's quite a compliment.
So we always try and make sure we keep one step ahead of what's going on, and so hence the program. Hopefully, is going to deliver that again this year.
Excellent. Well, we're very honored to be hosting some podcasts out there on stage at BME and some great interviews, so it's going to be a very fun week.
Good
Okay,
wrapping up with your final poem of today, Stories of Stars Leaving a Mark by Not Saying Much at All, growing businesses from record shops to radios to town halls. Respect a currency that pays its way when working with different people. Because after all, we're all human and get along best when we're treated as equals. If you're ready to move on, don't be hasty, but voice your feelings. You may then get proposed with offers that could be quite appealing. Now in a role that he loves, and when that happens, it's not really like you're working each day. So that's part one of telling his journey. Listen out for part two, coming soon your way.
Thanks, Ash. Nice.
Welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.